show up. With New York City schools closed, we're open. That's the way we go. Now, we are, a call for you in Masechet Chulin, Daf Chet Amud Bet. In the English, it is 8B2. 8B2. Now, let's actually go back a little bit. We'll review, start from the previous page, 8B1. Okay. So on the right side of the page, on 8B1, Itamar, this is now a discussion among the Amoraim. Hashochet b'sakin shel odei kochavim. If someone slaughters with the knife of an idolater, assumption being that that person has used the knife to slaughter non-kosher animals. Okay? So the knife itself has been used to slaughter these non-kosher animals. Rav amar kolech. And Rav says he must pare the meat. Now, pare the meat means cut off a limited depth of it. Cut it down.
With a different knife,
correct? No? Oh, yes, with a different knife, correct. With a different knife. So, in other words, when you get home, you have to cut off the edge that has been in contact with the meat. The Rabba Bar Chana Amar, and Rabba Bar Chana says, Madiach. You don't have to cut the meat, but it is enough to wash the meat. It is enough to wash the meat. Now, this is a basic concept, and the Gemara wants to analyze what the issues are that cause this difference of opinion between Rav and Rabba Bar Chana. Okay? Rav, remember, says that you have to the klof to pare it back. And Rabbi Bar Chana says all you have to do is wash off the area. Okay? Lema b'haika miflagei. Now the Gemara says, shall we assume that the difference of opinion is based on some basic different concept here? The marsavar bet ashrita zone. One of them thinks that the Beit HaShchita, the place where the Shchita, where the slaughtering takes place, that place in the neck where the animal has been cut in order to create the Shchita, Marisa Bar Beit HaShchita Tzonei. One point of view takes it and assumes that it is to be dealt with as if that place is cold. Umar Savar Beit HaShchita Roteach. And the other point of view is that that place is to be dealt with as if it is boiling water. Boiling water. Now, what is the issue here? First are the basic issues, and this is a central issue in the laws of Kashrut, dealing not only with knives, but with pots, and that is the significance of the application of heat. It is heat that causes a transfer of taste into a metal. Okay? It is heat that causes the transfer of taste into the metal. So, if we have something that is hot, and there's a forbidden item that is in contact with something that is hot, we have a problem. If we have something that is cold, and it is in contact with a forbidden item, we don't have a problem. Okay? So that's a general issue in the laws of kashrut. If, for example, you have, let's just say, a knife or a fork. You have a knife or a fork. And you take out a meat fork and you eat something on a milk plate. And let's say you also, milk is there for whatever reason. Immediate question is, Was it hot or was it cold? That's the immediate question. If there is an application of significant heat, then we have an issue, we have a problem. If there is no application of heat, if it's sonein, cold, then there's no problem. Because if there is sonein, nothing enters into the item itself, but instead we have to be concerned about the external reality of the item. And so what we do is we wash it. So here the Gemara takes this distinction between cold and hot and applies it to this difference of opinion between Rav and Rabba Bar Hana. Let's just make sure we have it clear. Okay, Rav says, kolet. Rav says, if that non-kosher knife has cut through the kosher animal, alright, in the Beit HaShechita, where the Shechita takes place, in the windpipe in the esophagus area. Just think to yourselves, when you are cutting an animal, kosher animals are all warm-blooded animals. Right? So the fact is, once you cut into the animal, you're cutting into a warm-blooded animal. So there is, in fact, heat involved. But the question is how much heat. And the question is really, what is the threshold of heat that you consider it to be hot enough to transfer the characteristics? Okay? So that's the difference between the two of them. That's a good insight of the Gemara. It's a good insight of the Gemara that it is on that point that the two of them differ. Okay? Questions so far?
The practical example you gave was where there was a meat on a dish with milk.
Okay.
And you stuck the fork in.
No, I know it, right? I didn't put meat there. I just took the wrong fork.
The wrong fork is right. The answer was to wash it off.
Right.
Hot water or cold water?
To wash it off? Either one. Doesn't matter. Best thing is to wash it off first with cold and then with hot. First with cold, then with hot.
Can it just be cold water that you're talking about?
Yeah, cold water is enough.
But hot water would be wrong.
Now, the problem with the hot water is if you heat the thing up and you've got the milk on it already, then you're creating a problem for yourself. But we're back to where we started just a minute ago. How hot is the hot water? How hot is the hot water? Okay? That's the issue here. How hot does it have to be? And in fact, the general principle is that it has to be hot enough so that you draw a hand away. Right? That's the general principle. Okay? But on this, there are details. People disagree. Right? Different people take different points of view on how much actual heat there needs to be. Now, it's not quite as clear-cut as I just made it, though. And that's what the Gemara now will analyze. Okay? Marseva beta shchita roteach. One person has the point of view that we treat the place of the shchita as if it's sonein, it's cold, even though in fact it's not cold, but it's for all practical purposes cold because it's not at that threshold. The other one says beta shchita roteach. Roteach literally means boiling. Well, of course it isn't really boiling, but that point of view is that it's close enough to that so that it crosses the threshold. Okay? Now the Gemara then goes on and says, no, doesn't agree. This is not a proper analysis. The kuliyama beta shchita roteachu. I can analyze it in the following way, that both of them, Rav and Rabba Bar Chana, both take the point of view that the beta shchita, alright, this spot, is to be considered roteach. That is to say, it's hot enough to cross that threshold. So then how could they differ? Oh, here's how they differ. Man diamar kolev shapir. The one who says that you have to pare it back, well, that makes sense. We understand that because it's hot enough to enter into the thing itself. Man diamar madiach. But the one who says just wash it with the cold water, what's his point of view? How could he justify that? I did the three de simanim la puke dam lo bale. He says, since, in fact, the act of shchita is an act which causes a significant blood flow from the animal, that blood flow itself works against the animal absorbing anything because there's blood coming out. So in fact, it purges in a way the whole area simply because of the flow of blood. So even if you consider it to be roteach, that it's hot enough to be considered to be hot, still the fact of the blood and the fact that the blood works counter to absorption, well, you could even have both of them taking the place of the roteach. And it goes on and it says, in addition, no bummer. Right, ika di amre, but there are those who say the kuli alma beta shchitat sonein. You could take the opposite point of view, and you could say both of them, Rav and Rav Abba Bar Chama, both of them take the point of view that the beta shchitah is cold, even though it's warm, but we consider it to be cold, not that warm. Okay, man di amar madiach shapir. Oh, so the one who says you just wash it with cold water, well, we understand that. That's obvious because it's cold. It's cold. But the one who says you pair it, he has the point of view that even though it's cold, the very action of the cutting puts pressure on the area itself, and the addition of the pressure causes the absorption to take place. So, in fact, we're not sure which one. It could go either way, if it's hot or if it's considered to be cold. Okay? Any questions still here? Okay? We'll go on a little bit further. Sakin trefa. Now, so far we talked about, let's just get straight what this last example was. The last example was, you had a knife that was used to slaughter non-kosher animals. Okay? That was the beginning of the example. A knife is used to slaughter non-kosher animals. We assume as a result of that the knife may have absorbed something into itself. Okay? Either because it's hot or the pressure, one of those possibilities. What we're worried about then is when that same knife then goes into the kosher animal, as something came in, something will go out. Right? It absorbed on the one hand, and it's giving back what it had absorbed. That's the potential problem here. One other possible problem, and that is just that the outside of the knife is dirty. Okay, the outside of the knife could also be a problem here. But that's what we were describing, and we're worried now about the kosher animal. I gave you the example last week of fish in the fish store. Very common problem we have here on the Upper East Side. Okay, it's an Upper East Side problem. It's a problem even though you worked on that over at Eli's, at the Zebars, Eli's, right? Eli's. It went for naught eventually. Because for a while, they had separate knives. And if you came in and you asked for a kosher piece of fish, you wanted to have saffron, you said, would you use the kosher knife? They would take the separate knife and they would cut it for you. No longer. You asked for a piece of salmon, they cut it with the same knife that they cut the shark with. Okay? So they're serving shark. You cut the knife with the shark. There you go. That's a non-kosher fish. Okay? All the issues that we're talking about now at least are somewhat relevant. It's not exactly relevant. I'll tell you one reason it's not relevant. Well, let's just see the facts of the case. Here we're dealing with heat, right? We're dealing with heat, and we're saying that the animal self-generates enough heat that maybe we should consider it to be roteach, or the pressure. Realize that when you're dealing with fish in a fish store, how is it usually there? Frozen. It's cold. It's sitting on ice usually, because that's the way, in fact, it's sold in a fish store. So that particular issue, it doesn't disappear entirely, because you still might have the view that the act of cutting is itself the crucial act, and cutting itself causes heat. There's probably some truth to that. In fact, when you do you know, even when you create a fire. I was talking with somebody who was explaining to me that they were on an outward bound kind of trip, and they just put them, they let them go into the woods with nothing. So the challenge for the outward bound is that you have to make a fire. How do you make a fire? All Boy Scouts know that early on in your 10-foot training, you learn how to make a fire, you get a little piece of wood, you go like this, and you make it go against something that's flammable, like some dry leaves, and lo and behold, poof, you get a fire. So it's friction that causes heat, right? Friction causes heat. So there's friction up in the night. So one could raise issues with that, and there are issues raised with that. But it's somewhat analogous here, the issue of the fish store, because it's just so common with us. I mean, we don't have this issue with the distribution of meat, because generally speaking, either you have a kosher meat market or you have a non-kosher meat market. It's not both. It's either or. One should not assume we assume because of that that's a reflection of the slaughtering arrangements, which is one of the things that was so interesting that Naftali Hanna spoke about, that in fact kosher slaughtering takes place in the same plant as non-kosher slaughtering. And I was surprised to learn that. And it's partly because we assume from our experience of the butcher that things are separate. Or we have, you know, a lot of meat is sold these days, or at least chicken is sold, in the supermarket. And there's packaging. It's already packaged somewhere else, God knows where. It's packaged somewhere else. And therefore, it's separate, and so things don't come in contact. The only place where you come in regular contact is in the fish store. The fish store is the most common place. So there, that's the key issue then. Do you have to cut off the edge of the fish? That would be the analogous to paring here. The cloth, klifa, is to pare it back, cut off the edge. Or is it enough just to wash it? Just to wash it. That would be the two different points of view. Right? Those are the two different points of view. I'll read to you the halacha in a moment, but remember that very frequently with the laws of kosher and so many other areas, even if we see what the halacha is, it doesn't mean that that's what people do. Generally speaking, people are they're stricter than the halacha is. It's an interesting, I don't know why, I'm not a sociologist, but generally speaking, practice goes beyond the halakha itself, as you'll see. Yes.
Through the whole discussion here, we are talking about sakin trefa or animal that are prey.
We didn't begin that yet. Hold on. All right, hold on. Let's go into that now. So I just wanted to make clear what the first issue was. The first issue was the knife gets to be, let's say, tainted, and then the knife ends up tainting the cut that's made. Right? This next issue is slightly different. It's slightly different, and both Rashi and the Tosafot point out the slight difference. Sakin trefa. Sakin trefa. Trefa in the Talmud does not mean what it means when we say trefa. Okay? We've said that before, but that is a trick in reading this little sugya here. Sakin trefa means you have a kosher slaughter. You have a shochet that slaughtered the animal properly. After he slaughtered the animal, he examines the innards of the animal. And he finds, lo and behold, that animal is a trefa. A trefa means that animal suffered some sort of injury that might have been a mortal injury. Okay? That's the definition of trefa. That's the difference. It's not tref. When we say tref, we mean non-kosher. That's not what it means here in the Talmud. It means that there's been a perfectly kosher slaughter, and afterwards, the shochet sees that the animal is a treif animal. Now he's got a problem with his knife. He's got a problem. He didn't realize he had a problem with his knife. He didn't do anything to cause the problem with his knife. Except after the fact, he realizes that there is a problem because that animal is not tareh. And there was no way to know it beforehand. Not until he stuck his hands into the animal did he know that the animal was tareh. Right? So the question is, what does he have to do with his knife before he proceeds? Because he examines the innards. Part of the job of the shochet. Absolutely. That's what this whole tractate is about. A lot of the tractate is about animal biology. It's animal biology. People have known animal biology forever and ever. Why? Because they eat animals. We're omnivorous beings. We eat vegetables and we eat animals, and therefore the knowledge, just as far as knowledge goes, is, well, I can tell you, they know a lot more than I do, because we don't go into the innards of an animal. We buy it in the food emporium. You know, what do you know when you know in the when you're buying the food emporium? It wasn't so long ago, and you probably remember this, that you'd go to the butcher and you'd actually see, you could see half an animal. You'd go to buy a chicken, and you buy, still it's the case in many parts of the world, in some places in Israel it's the case, you don't buy a dead chicken. No good housewife would buy a dead chicken. You buy a live chicken. Because a dead chicken, who knows how long it's been dead? Okay? We buy dead chicken. We not only buy dead ones, we buy packaged ones. They're in plastic. God knows what's happened to them. We depend on the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, to do these things. I heard Barack Obama last night. He's not even sure we should have one. You know, there are all kinds of problems with these parts of the government. And Naftali was very good at that. He says, you know, some of these things... It's okay according to the laws of the USDA, but it's not okay according to the laws of kashrut, which is why half the kosher meat bought in America is bought by Gentiles, because they realize that it's a stricter standard. You go up here into Harlem, there's plenty of kosher meat that's bought in Harlem. You can buy kosher meat over in 125th Street in, Fairway up on 125th Street. And Most of the business there is from the blacks and the Puerto Ricans. I mean, that's a major piece of the business because they want things that are kosher. Paul, you're hanging in there.
Yeah. So you explained that the context here is an animal that's draped in the sense of especially the innards, but wouldn't have known that in advance. But once he's in that predicament, does it really make a difference, or would it be exactly the same situation if it had been a non-kosher animal? If somehow this knife had been used,
It's the same issue. The only difference is that we haven't gotten to stage two yet. He hasn't slaughtered with it yet. So we're in the first case. My hope here really is just to define the difference between these two sugyot. The first sugya, we had to worry about whether we wash off the animal, whether we cut off something from the animal. That was the case. This case, we're dealing just with the knife. However, the Tosafot do raise a difference between these two situations. And this will come up a little bit later. We may come across it looking at the Tosafot, but it's as follows. They say, well, let me see whether I can find where this is mentioned. Doesn't jump out at me. There is an additional difference which you sense between these two situations, and the difference is that the shochet and the problem of his knife is something that, of course, we could decide that it's cold and that it's not going to be a problem at all. That's one possibility. But it's a rare problem. It doesn't happen all the time. Tosafot raise the difference between that and the knife used to do non-kosher slaughtering is that it's constantly used for non-kosher slaughtering. So that they are worried. They say, in a case, well, we can be lenient in a case when something happens just once in a while. However, when we know that something is used on a regular basis, then if we're talking about absorption, there's more likelihood that it will absorb. Since we're in a gray area here and we're deciding which way to go, to one way, to lenient or to more stringent, they will go more stringently with a thing that's used regularly, and that's the knife of Avodah Zarah. The knife of the shochet, on the other hand, is just a chance kind of thing, and therefore they go leniently with that. That's a difference that they make. Okay, good. So here we are on the right side of 8b2, sakin trefa. A knife was used to slaughter a trefa, and we now know that what is. Beligi barav acha rabina. Right, there is a difference now between two rabbis, Rav Acha and Rabina. They differ about what to do with this knife. Chad amar bechamin. One said that it must be purged through immersion in boiling water, through chamin. Okay? Dechad amar bitzonehin. And the other one said it must be purged with tzonein, with just cold water. Okay? Now it's a similar situation. We've got the hot and the cold. Right? And as we saw that there was a difference before, that difference was based on the Beit HaShechita, whether to be considered that hot or cold. The general principle of hot or cold is here. So, Chad Amar Bechamin, if you have to clean that knife with hot water, that means that we assume that the knife has absorbed. Because the only way to get out something that has been absorbed by the knife is through the application of heat. Therefore, he must assume that the act of shechita itself was a hot act. It was a roteach. It was to be considered roteach. And that was Rav Acha's point of view, or we assume it's Rav Acha, the first one. And the second one, V'chad amar b'tzonein, the other one says you can use cold water. His point of view, therefore, was that the Beit HaShechita is considered cold, and therefore that there's really no absorption. And the only concern that you have then is what's external on the knife, and you can remove what's external simply with cold water. Okay? Nothing has been absorbed. Nothing has been absorbed. And the interesting thing is the very next statement of the Gemara. The Gemara says, the Hilchata afilu betzonein. The law is, even cold water is enough. The law is, even cold water is enough. And then it goes a little bit further. The iika belita befarsa lenichpere lotzarech. And if there is blita de farsa, according to Rashi, is some, the second word here is farsa. Farsa, he defines as masach. A masach. A masach means a vilon, a curtain. Blita means balui, masach balui. In other words, a ruined, an old curtain. And what he is getting at is that if you have a rag, something that in fact, a rag is a recycled something or other that you use. This is not the kind of rag, though, which is used for polishing. No, it's not. I know in my house, that's what the dedicated use of my white shirts and my underwear is. Now, after it's had a useful life, they turn into polishing racks. And that's the way I recycle everything at home, okay? You know, God forbid you should throw something out. Instead, we use it to polish the silver. And eventually make Shabbos beautiful from my junk. So I'm not talking about that. We're talking about rags that are rough, that you would not want to use for polishing. So here, listen to what he's saying here. The iika blita da farsa. If you have a rag that is an old rag, it says, lo tzarich. In other words, if you pull the rag over the knife, that's sufficient and you don't even need the cold water. You don't even need the cold water. So what he is saying is simply this is a problem that's external. We're not worried about any of the taste going into the knife itself. Right? We're not worried about that. Simply what's on the outside. And if we're worried about what's on the outside, there are really two ways to remove it. One is with water. And we're not concerned about it being warm water. Cold water is perfectly fine. Or, in fact, if you have a rough piece of fabric, that's also another way to remove it. Okay? All right. Any questions, Tony? Yes?
I want to go back to the previous case, the knife that here the question of cleaning the knife as opposed to cleaning the
food.
Right. Doesn't even enter into the question. Is that because of the fact that you assume it was repeatedly used and probably used it when he was eating hot food? Or is it just the fact that it was the property of an idol worship? It doesn't say, you know, nobody introduces the idea, well, you could clean the knife off with hot water or cold water before using it.
It's impossible to know. I wouldn't need to extrapolate too much from it because I don't know that we can know the answer.
Is there some prohibition against property belonging to...
It wouldn't be a prohibition. It would just be, as we'll see in a little while, we're concerned about the use of knives, that we be careful with knives. So where we assume that knives are used for unkosher purposes, it would make sense to be careful and to create some sort of procedure if there's any likelihood that these things will be mixed. Now, I can't imagine when that would happen, to tell you the truth, because in our general practice, we just don't let that happen. We're careful. What I'm wondering about was what Naftali was talking about in terms of the slaughterhouse, whether those are practical problems in the slaughterhouse, because in fact, there is an intermingling, which I'd never thought of before. But otherwise, I don't think it's a practical issue.
So in the case of the fish store,
okay.
There, it's not a question of using the same knife, but washing it in hot water or boiling it, and then you can use it. The fact that you used it at all, presumably, you know, they do wash these. The fact that you're using it means you have to do something about the surface.
I watch the fish store to see how they do it. And they don't wash it. But they probably wash it once a day. Maybe more, but not a lot more. I see the way they go. They have a knife, and they use it for whatever they need it for.
They're constantly taking like paper towels and wiping up because the scale.
Yeah, exactly. There's a certain amount of cleaning that does go on. You're right, because it just gets dirty. So, but the way they usually do it is with paper towels. Something like that. It's usually not with water. But now we've seen the entrance of a possibility here. It could be that the paper towel could also have something, could be significant enough to make it more or less okay. It's possible.
You're right.
Example of extreme.
Right, that's right. That was an extreme case, because there was the additional issue that was raised of something being an accessory to idolatry. And the extent to which simply having become an accessory to idolatry, this whole new bunch of prohibitions fall upon that thing. So that's a more extreme case. So obviously in this case, they're not dealing with that. Yeah?
I want to go back to the question I raised before. Obtei kochavim sometimes slaughter draped animals. They're not, that they hunt them and then they are draped and they cut them and they eat them.
Right.
We can take this knife, clean it, and have a kosher shechita later with kosher animal.
Correct.
What happened if that knife...
Well, I'm not sure what we have to do with it, because it could be that we have to boil it. Or
what
are we going to do? There's a way, there is a takana. There's a way to fix the problem.
What happened if this knife killed a shechatu nevela? Obtei kochavim can eat nevelo. We don't eat, but they...
Correct. Correct. So it's not a problem. It's not a problem for the Gentile, but it would still be the same problem for us.
Yeah. So we take a knife of Obed Avodah Zarah.
Right.
We clean it, and we have a kosher shechitana.
Correct.
What happened if the knife was a knife that was dealt with a nevela?
Same thing.
Same thing.
Same. Doesn't matter.
So Abiyah Tum'ah doesn't.
Tum'ah has no effect on this at all.
Okay.
Tum'ah is irrelevant. It's irrelevant. Has no effect on this.
Even for shechita lekodesh
zeva. Oh, the kodashim. That's another subject. But we're talking about chulin.
No,
we are talking about food. Food, it's not a problem. For chulin, it's not a problem. If it were kodashim, then we've got a big problem.
A regular wash or a rag.
You're going to see, but that, you don't. You're. I learned last time at the end of our class. You are familiar with certain other practices which you were wondering about, and they weren't rags. What did you say was the thing that you
put the knife in the soil.
You put the knife in the ground, all right? You bury a knife. You do something like that. Okay. We're going to get there in a little bit, but we've now seen the basic principles that will be relevant as far as that goes. Okay? Now, I want to introduce, we're going to read some Tosafot now. Tosafot, remember, are 12th century. We are studying the Rashbam on Saturday mornings now. And Rashbam was one of the Tosafot. His father was also a Tosafist. These are the generation of one and two generations after Rashi. Okay? So all Frenchmen. These are their comments on the text and on the Rashi. There are a few terms that will be used in the Tosafot that I want to just note to you. And they're very important terms for the study of Kashrut. One is Hagalah. Hagalah. Hagalah is where we take something that has a problem with it, whatever that the problem is, if you've got some sort of a kosher problem, and we put it in boiling water. Boiling, the act of putting something in boiling water is called hagalah. Hagalah. Okay? So in the example that we were just using, if we have a knife that's a problem, and that could be any of several different problems. It could be a trefa problem. It could be a milk and meat problem. You use a milk knife and you put it in some hot meat. All right, the milk knife got in the hot meat. So we've got whatever our problem is. These are problems that were caused by heat. And as long as the nature of the heat was boiling water, the way we solve the problem is also by boiling water. If the nature of the application of heat was not boiling water, there's another way to apply heat, and that's in the oven. Okay? That's another tool. Might as well put that one out there, too, since that one comes up once in a while. That's called libun. Libun. It's interesting in the Hebrew. In English, we say something that's heated to a great heat is red hot. In Hebrew, it's libun, it's white hot, right? From lavan, from the Hebrew word for lavan. So in theory, we do that also in English. Something that's white hot is even hotter than something that's red. But you don't have any term classically used in Hebrew. So if something, for example, was used in the oven, and you end up with a problem of taref, or a problem of milk and meat, the solution to that problem will be through libun. You'll have to apply a greater level of heat to it. That's not the most common. That's really a relatively rare kind of problem, relatively speaking. Much more common issues have to do with things that are connected to boiling, simply because most of what we eat, in fact, is done on top of the oven. There's a tremendous amount of stuff that's cooked on top of the oven. So hagalah is where you dip something into boiling water. You dip it into boiling water. Okay. Next is the concept of bar yoma. Let's say that we have a meat pot. And I have this every once in a while. It drives me crazy. They have a very lovely woman who comes in once a week as the housekeeper. And one of the things that she does is she puts everything away. I've learned a long time ago never to leave a pot out. Because, teach her as I may, she's not around enough. Some people have regular household help. And their household help, in fact, they learn the laws of kashrut and they can tell the difference between the pots. That's perfectly doable. I'm sure some of you live with this arrangement. You told me that your wife trains a Nepalese lady. She's from Nepal. Excellent. You can do this. And believe me, Gentiles are wonderful and they try to be very careful. When you don't have somebody who's there that regularly, though, the subtleties often escape the person because they don't do it regularly. So I know that before the maid comes, I make sure there's not a pot out, which is a pity because I'd really like to leave the pots there. It's a good pain in the neck to have to put the pots away. Because every time I forget, something potentially disastrous happens. It happened to me the other day. I couldn't find a pot. This is Friday. I'm in a rush, I'm telling. I'm in a big rush, I'm telling. I've got a lot to do. So I go to make something, and I pull out the pot from the meat, or the place where the meat pots are, put the pot on the oven. I look at this pot, I say, something's wrong with this pot. I look and I say, oh my God, this is the dairy pot. How in the world did the dairy pot ever get into the meat cupboard? I know, I forgot to put it away before the maid came. And so she put it in the wrong place. So I live in constant fear. That's one of the fears of my life. Right? Is this. But on the other hand, these problems can be solved. They can be solved. If God forbid I had done that, there would be a solution to the problem. And it always has to do with these issues. First of all, let's say you have the problem. You have taken the meat pot. Well, let's say the dairy pot. Okay, I have a dairy pot. Last thing I did was I cooked, made a spaghetti sauce. I put cheese in it. It's my dairy pot. Not a problem. Perfectly fine, okay? The maid puts it back in the wrong cupboard. Right? I take it out. And I take it out on Friday, all right? I made the cheese sauce on Monday. I'm going fast on Friday. I take it out to make for my Shabbos meal, which is going to be a meat meal. And I use the wrong pot. What happens to my meal? Okay. That's the question. That's the question. I have a problem. But the question is, what kind of a problem? Got a problem. Solve this problem. We need to have the concept of bar yoma and notei tam mitkam. Bar yoma, sometimes called ben yom or bat yom, depending upon the gender of something, is 24 hours. 24 hours after an item has been used for a particular purpose, it maintains a strong absorptive taste of whatever you used it for. Okay? Bar Yoma means in the first 24 hours. Ben Yom. 24 hours. After 24 hours, its status changes. Its status changes. Because it just becomes weaker. Becomes weaker. And at that point, it is called Noten Tam Nifkam. It gives forth a taste weakly. Right? It gives forth a taste weakly. So a lot of the questions that you have to answer in the laws of kosher involve finding out, one, whether heat was applied, and number two, when it was applied. When it was applied. If I made my dairy spaghetti sauce on Monday, and on Friday I had a problem, then in fact by Friday, the pot is noten tam nifkam. Noten tam nifkam. It gives forth the taste weakly. W-E-A-K-L-Y. At that point, it doesn't destroy whatever I've made in the pot. It doesn't destroy what I've made in the pot. So in fact, I can eat what I made in that pot. I can eat what I made in that pot. Okay? It may not be intuitive. Because we tend to think that there's an absolute difference between the meat pot and the dairy pot. But according to the laws of kashrut, there are stages. And it has to do simply with absorption and giving back taste. And that too is also intuitive if you think about it, but it's not something we usually think about. Okay? So here you go, you have Hagalah is the way to deal with the problem. If we have something which is Bar Yoma in particular, then we have a really serious problem, because during that first 24 hours we have that serious. One of the ways to deal with it also is to let time pass. And usually what we do is we do two things. We let 24 hours pass, and then we subject it to Hagalah. We don't do Hagalah during the first 24 hours. We do Hagalah after 24 hours. That way you know that simply certain amount has already disappeared. No tentam nifkam. And then you subject something to Hagalah. You will notice, you'll get it within the next few weeks, the laws of Pesach are not exactly the same, but they're quite similar. They're really based on the same principles. In the preparation of the dishwasher, for example, or the preparation, it's a big issue in glasses on Pesach. How do you kosher glassware? Glassware. Just regular glasses. Glasses that... Glasses is an interesting problem, because the question is, does glass absorb? Does glass absorb? Generally speaking, in the halacha, glass does not absorb, except that glass that is made to go into the oven does absorb. Okay, there's a difference. If you take a regular glass and you put it in the oven, it'll break. It cannot expand. Ovenware that's made from glass, Pyrex, is a certain way of constituting the glass so that it can expand and contract, which is unusual for glass, which for Pyrex is a highly scientific development, Pyrex. Pyrex we treat as if it's a clay pot. If you ever ask me a question about Pyrex, I treat Pyrex exactly the same as a clay pot, not glass.
Corningware the same thing?
Corningware is the same thing. Corningware is dealt with as a clay pot. Okay? Right? Not everybody, this is, you want this rabbi's determination on this thing? For these reasons. Because the very fact that it can go into the oven means that it has to be able to expand. Because it can expand, it can absorb. Okay? When it's heated. And that's what we're interested in. That's the issue. So what was I saying? What did I get into that?
Yes.
Oh, it's in Pesach. In Pesach, with the glasses, for example, if you read the literature on glasses, it's something to read. There's absolutely no reason, in my opinion, that you have to that you have to be worried about galoshes on Pesach. Galoshes that are used all year, you put them in the dishwasher, you wash them. Simply the outside that we're concerned about, they don't absorb. It came to be the tradition in Eastern Europe to put them in the tub and to leave them in a tub for 24 hours. As I said to you, what happens with these laws is that the more stringent position usually ends up being the practice. So if you read any of the things, with the exception of what you read from Conversation or Zaruah, you will see that you're supposed to put them in a tub for 24 hours. I think that's completely crazy. There's absolutely no reason to put your glasses anywhere. Once they're clean, glass doesn't absorb, it's not a problem. Okay? However, the other things really go according to these laws. If we either, I mean, you know, we try not to do too much of it today because thankfully we're affluent enough to generally be able to have separate pots for Passover, right? But if you don't, then these things can be kosher. They can be kosher using these exact same principles. That's the way we have the basis of the principles. Okay? Question still here.
When you measure the 24 hours, are you doing it from the finishing of the cooking of that, say, spaghetti sauce or cheese, or if you left, say you left it in that pot and they, you know, to eat it for a couple of
days? It's a good question. It would be while it was to the point when it was no longer hot. So in other words, it probably wouldn't be the minute you took it off the stove, but it'd be roughly that. Not just leading it, because if you stick it in the refrigerator afterwards, it's not a problem.
You said it was treif, and what you could eat the treif stuff that was cooked in the pot?
I didn't say it was treif.
He was saying about eating it.
No, he didn't say anything about eating it.
And once it's treif, whatever you make in the pot is treif, right?
If we're talking, well, it depends. Let's say you had a treif a pot, the way we use the word treif, had a treif a pot. Well, why should you have a treif a pot? You wouldn't have a treif a pot. Okay. So there's no reason to answer
it. You made a treif.
Oh, how did you make a treif? Give me the details.
You have a milchic pot.
Okay.
By accident, you put.
I said to you, if I made the sauce on Monday and I created this problem on Friday, I don't have a problem. I do not have a problem.
Eating it?
I can eat it without a problem. My meat meal is not unkosher. My meat meal and my pot is okay. Although what we will generally do is that we'll eat the food but then kosher the pot. Okay? Because we don't want to throw out the food if we don't have to. You don't have to. And as long as we're in the case of Notem Dam Nitgam, right, we know that this is the case. If it's Bar Yoma, then we got a problem. Then we're going to have to throw out the
and
food.
And if it's a kosher pot and you put milk in it, food, you can eat the food too? Nope.
Depends. Did you let 24 hours pass yet? Okay. If you didn't let 24 hours pass, you got a problem. And you can't eat the food. If you let the 24 hours pass, then you can do it. Right? We don't recommend it, but it's a way of solving a problem. You can solve the problem. The problem is a solvable problem. Okay? Okay. Let's go from here. Let's look now at the Tosafot, and we will look at a variety of Tosafot. This is Daf Chet Amud Bet. Look at the first Tosafot, for example. Hashochet besakin ovde kochavin rav amar kolef. That's what we had read last time. We read it at the very beginning of tonight's class. Tzarich la'amid biyod'in ba shehi bat yoma. If we say that you have to cut off, you have to pare back the meat that was cut, that assumes biyodin ba shehu bat yoma. That assumes that the knife was a bat yoma knife. Now, bat yoma knife means within 24 hours of the act that you did. Because if it were after 24 hours, we would be more lenient with it. But within the first 24 hours, there would be a problem, and therefore, the point of view that you have to pare it back, that presupposes that it's within 24 hours. Okay? The ilavachi amaykolif, because if that were not the case, why would you have to pare it back? Right? Because now we know the concept of bar yoma. L'rav hastam kelim shelo bekochavim enan b'nei yoma. Rav takes the point of view that stam b'nei, that the by and large we can make an assumption about Gentiles that their pots or their knives enan b'nei yoma. They're not b'nei yoma. More time has gone by. They don't use things constantly. You know, they're not always reusing the same things. Just because that's what we do, so we can assume that they live the same way. And then it raises another thing, a little bit further. Misupaklei ligmara. You see where I am? I just skipped a little bit. Misupaklei ligmara. The gmara is uncertain. In savar rav notein tam nifkam mutar. It's uncertain, even in the Talmud, they were not sure about this principle of notein tam nifkam. The second principle, the third line there, that's to say something that's after 24 hours, whether it's mutar or hasur. I'm telling you that it's permissible, but in the Talmud, they were not sure. Some took the point of view that notein tam nifkam is hasur, it's prohibited. Some took the point of view that notein tam nifkam is mutar, that it's permissible. Okay? Let's see, where do we have a little... down a few lines from that, it says, "V'hitiruhu mishum de kasavre notein tam nifkam mutar." And they permitted this thing because it was eventually concluded that notein tam nifkam is mutar. It's permissible. Etam nifkam dekamar hainu mishum de'enam b'nei yoma. And the reason that something that it doesn't give forth any taste is because it's not during the first 24 hours. The ain lomar da afilu ahava hashamnunit ba'ayin hu notein tam nifkam. And we don't assume that if there was fat on the outside of it, that has any impact on the thing. Of course, you have to clean off whatever is on the outside. But what our real interest was what was on the inside, whether something that was absorbed is coming out in a particular action that we have. Okay? Now go down to the next Tosafot. Agav duchka, desakina bal'a. Now that was the point of view that it was all cold. The Beit HaShchita was cold. But agav duchka, as a result of pressing, the knife absorbs. As a result of pressing, the knife absorbs. Harav Yitzchak Bar Meir. Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Meir was one of the Tosafists, one of the French rabbis who was living at that particular time. Yitzchak Bar Meir, Hayam Matzrich Mitochkach, would require as a result of this, Liachar Shenakru Hachelev, after they had removed the fats. There are, remember, prohibited fats. They're prohibited fats. We'll get to that in a little bit. We're about one halfway down the page in the Tosafot. This is 8b, Chet Amud Bet. Chet Amud Bet. In the removal of the prohibited fats, mina behema, lachazor veliklof bechol makamot shechatach besakin, mishum debala mina chelet. So this rabbi took the point of view that wherever the prohibited fats were, once you remove them, right, the Torah prohibits those chelev. The problem with the word chelev is we translate it as fat. Fat is not prohibited according to the laws of kashrut. It may be, you'll tell me whether it's good or it's not good for you to eat, but it's not prohibited by the laws of kashrut. Chelev is a kind of fat, certain fats of the animal, which were used on the altar. They were brought to the altar. Those are prohibited for general consumption. Okay? That's what chelev means, those specific fats. So he takes the point of view then that, let's say you remove the fats from the animal. Well, the fat was in contact with something next to it. Right? That fact, he therefore says, means that you have to cut away, you have to tear back what was ever next to, whatever was next to the fact. Okay? Because of the duchka de sakina, because of the pressure of the knife. Even though there was no real heat applied, because a knife cut off the fat, a knife applied a pressure, and that pressure was enough to create a problem. Okay? So that was his practice, already talking about the 12th century France. The chen kusher mevi'in basar mitabachei odei kochavim. This is fascinating. This is an insight into the kashrut practices of France in the 12th century. Look what it says here. Similarly, when we would bring meat from Gentile butchers, right, the animals were cut up in the Gentile butchers. Right, they were butchered by Gentiles. It may have been that a Jew was the shochet, but the animal was butchered by Gentiles. Matzrich lich klof b'chol makom shechatach oved kochavim. There is the necessity to cut off every area where the knife of the Gentile cut. Okay? It's for this very same reason. The idea then is that you have to pare back, and that became then practice in 12th century France, and is generally still the practice. B'chol makom shechatach oved kochavim b'kopit shelo, with his knife, or besakino, or kopit is actually a hatchet. We assume that his hatchet or his knife, they were, in our terminology, trefa, knives and hatchets, and therefore, even though if the animal was a kosher animal, because he cut it that way, we have a problem, and we simply have to cut back a little bit of the animal. V'yesh limtso ta'am al minag shalanu shenagu lahakel. But there is also reason to be had, namely from the coldness, from the possibility that we can deal with this as if it were something cold, to deal with this leniently. So in other words, there were two practices. There was the more stringent practice, which required cutting back on the meat, and the more lenient practice, which simply required the washing of the meat. Now, we don't do that today, because we don't deal with the Gentile butcher. The only analogous situation that we have, and in fact we have today, is the fish. That is the analogous, and therefore you have two different practices with the fish. According to my point of view, which was sort of coming across from what I said to you before, the fact that the fish is kept so cold, I think mitigates in favor of dealing with the whole situation as if it is tsonen. It's cold, and we don't worry about the pressure of the knife. But I can tell you that many people do not agree with that point of view, but that happens to be my personal point of view on the matter. Yes.
To help Ross get his business, what if we had him separate all the trading fish, the shark, the shrimp, and had a section with all the elegant fish, and they used one knife, the proper knife? Would that be acceptable?
You mean if you had two knives? You had a knife for the kosher fish and a knife for the knife.
Just kept all the trade fish, the shark, whatever else, the shrimp in one section. You had a section for all the elegant, beautiful fish.
Right.
Totally separate. And you only use that knife for the...
Do we have one knife or two knives?
You tell me what to do, I'll tell what to do.
Two knives. But Miriam said that they used to do that and they stopped doing it.
Eli, they don't have that anymore.
But they used to have it. For a while they had it. For a while they had it.
For a short while they did, because I asked them very within the last couple of weeks, and they said no. There's no sign there.
You don't need a rabbi to be supervised.
I'm not telling you that everybody would be happy with this, because many people will expect a rabbi to supervise. I would tell the congregants from Morzarua that was a better arrangement, maybe expensive because it's Eli's. But
Eli's
it's a better
place that has wild salmon, but not by the New York Times.
Not only the only place. I can tell you the other fish stores say they have wild salmon.
The time made it kosher.
It wasn't clear to me that in the large commercial slaughterhouses where the shtika is done by a shochet, that once they take the animal away, the butchering was also done by Jewish butchers or by staff?
It wasn't clear to me either. It wasn't clear to me whether it was done sometimes by the shochet and sometimes by the Gentile, or the shochet did both the Gentile butchering and the Jewish butchering. That was not clear to me.
I had the distinct feeling from the way he was describing the pressures and the animals keep coming, that the shochet was busy enough just doing the shechita, cleaning his knife and going on to the next animal, and they were being taken away.
You mean the Gentile stuff?
No.
The Jewish
Gentile
stuff?
No.
Well, the Jewish stuff could not be dealt with by the Gentile, because it could pop. I don't think in practice it is, simply because of the issue of the knives.
Yeah.
The knives are an issue.
But at that point, you're not concerned about the condition of the knife. I mean, so long as they have a set of knives to use. I mean, the butchering at that point.
True. But we'll get to that. We're going to see the issues, the number of knives that the butcherers are required to have. And that would be relevant to this discussion. Let's go a little bit further. I want to be sure that we get to the end of this issue. Now go down further to the last, not the last Tosafot, but the Tosafot that begins the Hilchata Afilu Bitzonein the Iika Blita the Parsa. Okay? Do you see that? That's on the right side, sort of two-thirds, three-quarters of the way down. That was the law is that we deal with the Beit HaShechita as if it's cold. No, that's not it. This was the question was on the night. It was the night. And if you have a rag, you don't even need the cold, you can simply use the rag. Okay? Now, the issue raised at the end of the tractate of Avodah Zarah, ne'itzat asara pa'amim bakarka, sticking the knife in the ground 10 times, lachtochba, in order to cut with it, so name b'sakin shel ovdei kochavim lo dami l'sakin trefa. This is not exactly the same thing as the knife that is a trefa knife. Now, the first time you've seen mention made of the ground, I want to show you what the end of the tractate of Avodah Zarah is about. Avodah Zarah means idolatry. And the last chapter of Masechet Avodah Zarah contains a lot of the laws of Kashrut, because it has to do with the relation of Jews and Gentiles. And some of the laws, such as forbidden wines, have as their purpose the creation of a separate social reality, so that Jews have limited intermingling with Gentiles. And that is clearly behind some of the law. Some of it has to do with the practices of the Gentiles, but some of it just has to do with creating distance between Jews and Gentiles. Some of it has to do simply with the fact that Jews lived among Gentiles, and certain things have to be defined, because you could have a knife, let's say, that could be used by the Gentile, who we assume would be using it for the non-kosher meat, and it could end up in the Jews, used by a Jew. So things like that occur in the last chapter of Masechet Avodah Zarah. That's the fifth chapter. The last Mishnah of the fifth chapter, I want to read to you the Mishnah, because you'll see the Gemara discusses one aspect of the Mishnah. Halokeach klei tashmish mihagoy. Somebody who borrows things that are usable from a Gentile. Now, these are things probably that are involved in food preparation. Okay? You borrow from a Gentile. Et shedarko lahabil yabil. If the way to kosher this item was by dipping it in water, namely cold, you can clean it with cold water. All right. So if this thing had only had contact with cold, then simply by washing it, you can make it usable. Lahag'il yag'il. Hagala. If this had come in contact with hot water when it was used by the Gentile, then to make it usable for you, you have to put it into hot water. You have to use hot water. Lilabein bu'ur, yilabein bu'ur. If it was used in the oven, then it has to go back into the oven in order to be koshered. So this is the source of the basic laws of how to kosher pots and pans.
It's metals.
Okay, it's metals. All of this, we're talking about metals. Okay, these are all metals.
Clay is not the same.
No, clay is completely different. Clay is completely different. Because clay has a level of absorption and doesn't give back. Okay? So hashapur v'ha'achskala melabnon ba'ur. Shapud is a spit. Skewer. Those two have to be dealt with high heat. Hasakin shafa tehi tahora. Now, very interesting. The last piece of the Mishnah says hasakin. Alright? A knife. Shafa. It's not clear what shafa means.
Chad.
What?
Chad.
Well, it could be hashafa. You polish it as if you were to sharpen it. Tehi tahora, and it is okay. So there is some sense here, it's not clear exactly what the Mishnah is getting at as far as knives go. So the Gemara at the end of the Masechet has got to deal with knives. Okay. And here, let me quickly read this to you. The Gemara talks about Hagala. Now, you know what Hagala means? That's boiling. The koshering of something for boiling. I'm just going to read the English translation. How does one purge utensils that require Hagala? Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna says, a small pot that needs Hagala has to be put into a large pot. That's the general principle. Let's say you have a pot, and it's a trefa pot. How do you make it kosher? You have to put it into a larger pot. You boil water in a larger pot. Okay? And then you put the smaller pot in the larger pot. That's the process. Now, that's why at KJ, for example, they have a mass Haggalah before Pesach. They use tremendous pots, and people come in with their pots, and they simply dump their pots in the communal pot. Okay? So that way you can kosher your pot for Passover. You can kosher your pot between milk and meat. You can buy a used pot. Let's say you buy a pot in a flea market. Okay? Okay? Normally we don't do it. We're affluent enough, so usually we don't do it. But in theory, in Jews have not always had as much money as we do. Okay? So you buy a pot in the flea market, you kosher it. You can kosher it. You put a small pot in a big pot. You boil the water in the big pot. You put the small pot in. It's kosher pot. Okay? Yoregedolamai. What about a big pot?
Put it in a big pot.
But there's some end to that, okay? An end to that. Tashma. Okay, the Gemara comes and tells you what to do. Come and learn. There was the cauldron, a huge pot, in the house of Rav Akavya that required Hagalah. So it tells you the story here. Ahavaleh, he affixed around this huge pot a rim of dough at its mouth, and thus enabling the cauldron to be completely filled with water. See, the problem with the big pot is not the most of the pot, it's the top of the pot. The top of the pot. Okay? Why? That's the problem. We have to get to the very top of the pot, because if something trait was cooking in that pot, it'll spatter. That's the reality of cooking, is that things spatter in cooking. Okay? So, the problem is, how do we boil something all the way up to the top of the pot? If you've ever tried to do it, you know what happens? It boils over and puts out the fire. Okay? So the burner goes out. So you have a theoretical problem here of how to do it. So the way that he used to do it was that he would put dough around it and build up the walls around the side of the pot. He would build an artificial outside higher than the pot itself. And then he would fill the pot up with water and boil it. So he'd fill the pot up all the way over to the top, but it wouldn't boil over and put the fire out because he had created this artificial rim around it. Amar Rava. Rava says, who could be so wise to perform Hagalah in a cauldron in such a manner? All right? If not Rav Akavya, who is a great person and capable of doing these things. He reasoned that since in the manner that the forbidden matter is absorbed into the lip of the cauldron, right, as it is absorbed into the very top edge of the cauldron, in the same manner it is expelled from it. All right? Therefore, just as the prohibited matter was absorbed through splattering of non-kosher food, so too it is expelled by the splattering of the boiling water. That's the application of this general principle now. Right? So that's the basic law of Hagalah, and it comes here from the end of Masechet Avodah Zarah. Okay? That's it. Yes. But what the Tosafot then say, okay, let me just add. The Tosafot then say that there's another way to do it, and that is to fill up the water, the boiling water, you boil it, shut off the heat, I mean for them they would just remove it to the side, and then you put a hot stone into the pot, and what the stone does causes the thing to boil over. Causes it to boil over. That's the way we do it, as a matter of fact. I don't use a stone. Whenever anybody asks me how to do it, I do it with two pliers, because I find that a stone is simply too hard to get a hold of. I don't know how you'd have to tie the stone and put it, use two pliers in the following way. I take the pot, fill the pot up, heat the pot up on the top of the stove, go to another burner. I take one set of pliers and I hold on to the other pliers. Okay? So, and I put that in the, and right in the flame. I heat up the pliers in the flame. I shut off the flame underneath the water. I then go with the red hot pliers and I drop it into the pot. The whole pot boils over and I've solved the problem.
The problem doesn't rain.
Okay, you clean up. Okay, then you clean up, right. But at least it's a neater way. I've tried several different ways, and that's the best way that I've found to do it. Wait, no questions yet? I got to get to the end here. Okay? Now the Gemara goes on. Amarav Ugba Barchama Vinoatsa Asarat Amin Bakarka. One also thrusts it. Now here we're doing with a knife. Oh, Hasakin Shafa Vihitora. Regarding the knife, there's a quote from the Mishnah. One scrapes it. Shafa there is understood by the Gemara to mean scrape. You scrape it and it is purified. That would be like the what? No, even less than that. It could be like this rag that we were just talking about, okay? So now the Gemara discusses this. Amar Rab Ukta Barchame V'noatza Asa Rapi Amin Bakarka. one can also thrust it 10 times into the ground. One can push it 10 times into the ground. Amar Rav Huna Bereva Rav Yehoshua, Rav Huna the son of Rav Yehoshua says, Uvakarka she'ena avuda, in only in ground that has not been tilled beforehand. Now what's the difference between ground that is tilled and not tilled? It's rougher. The idea here is that if you don't have a rough rag to use in order to clean the outside of something, a very easy way to do it, you probably have had this experience, when I've been out in the woods for any period of time, for example, and I can't clean my hands, what do? You wipe it on the dirt. You go into and you get some fresh dirt and you just wipe the hands on fresh dirt. It does a fairly good job. That's why, that is the source of putting the knife in the ground. It turned into a bubba-meiser, where people thought that the act of putting it in the ground was somehow magical. It's not a magical thing at all. The idea is that the dirt, when you have limited access to effective rags, the dirt itself is useful, and it says 10 times. The whole idea was to stick it in and out of the dirt several times like this in order to clean it.
But that's not the way it's
That's not the way it came to be. It came to be something completely different.
And then you left it. You left? 24 hours.
Correct. These are total bubba-meisers. They are bubba-meisers. They have to do with craziness and a little bit to do with the laws of tumor. But the laws of tumor, I've said again and again, have absolutely nothing to do with this. They're irrelevant. Completely irrelevant.
You slice a worm while you're sticking it in the ground.
Slice a worm, then you go to another place in the ground and you do it 10 more times. Alright? Until you get it right, you do it. Or, of course, we now have several different methods. We can wash it. We can use a rough rag on it. Or we can stick it in ground, but not ground that's smooth, ground that's effectively rough. The whole idea is to use something rough on it. In our modern environment, because we have a lot of other alternatives, here's a piece of spill wool. And this spill wool is a high-tech invention, which in effect creates the same, it achieves the same end. Right? But you have to understand the source of these things in the Gemara to realize the laws of Kashner are usually not so mystical. They're practical, and they actually, most problems can be solved as a result of the practical nature of the law.
So to go back to the smaller pot, the bigger pot, the smaller pot that was used incorrectly, and that you're going to put it in the other pot with all the water, putting the contaminated smaller pot...
You're afraid it's going to contaminate the big pot?
Contaminate the larger pot.
No, we're not worried about that. We're not worried about that because, of course, one thing that I didn't say, which I should have said, is you have to wait 24 hours.
Before you put it in the pot.
Correct. In the process of Hagalah, you are not mag'il immediately. You have to put something aside. First you wash it.
But how do you wash it?
With something.
You wash it with something? Yeah, I use paper towels. I use soap and water and paper towels. If I need something to... Because I don't want to...
You can't wash it with the meat stuff. I don't want to
dedicate and lose a sponge because it costs money. So I take a paper towel and I just wash it. You know, I use something like that. Or if I have an old piece of spill wool around or an SOS pad or something like that, I may also use it because I'm going to throw it away afterwards. Those are fairly disposable. So first you wash it. Then you let 24 hours pass. Then you put it into the boiling water. And then everything's fine.
So to go one step further with that, could you, on the other hand, if you don't want to go through that whole process, could you just turn that into, that use it for that kind of pot?
No, because at this moment it's tricky.
Oh, it's nothing.
Because
it's got
two things in it.
Yeah.
So we probably can't leave it, although there's another possibility that if certain things, if you leave them for a year,
oh.
Mm-hmm. Right.
After a year's passes,
right,
we say that it's already okay.
Right.
It's simpler.
Excuse me?
If it was a parf pot, you could simply convert it to let it stay.
Yes, true. If it were a parf pot, and it ended up meat or milk, and you wanted to leave it whatever it ended up as, you could.
Okay.
Yes.
On this issue of Bar Yoma that we just discussed, I don't understand why we develop two sets of tools for halav and basar. If we have the Bar Yoma concept and I started something, and it's, let's say, halavi, and the whole week I was dealing with it as a halavi, come Sunday I wash it in the dishwasher or whatever, next week I can start with basar. But all the week, I cannot change on the same week. So I can develop a system that it doesn't matter.
Well, it's
and that concept is great if you do it like
wait.
That.
There are, you probably are sensing, as is generally the case in the law, once you know what goes into the law, you say, well, I could push it this way, or I could push it that way. I have a system that I can... Well, I'm not sure you could push it that far. But I will tell you, for example, a very interesting thing. As far as dishwashers go, dishwashers. If you ask me, can you put, what do you do with milk and meat in a dishwasher? Do you need two dishwashers? Well, it's ideal. I had a friend who was a reformed rabbi who had two dishwashers. I said to him, but you eat treif outside. But he said, if I'm going to have a kosher kitchen, I'll eat pig in a restaurant. But in my house, I want it to be kosher. Okay. So he had two dishwashers. He had two Cuisinarts. He had two of everything, this guy. But he really didn't keep kosher. If he really had to keep kosher, he wouldn't have to have everything because it's too complicated. It's too expensive. People who keep kosher have got to figure out how to live with this thing. It's got to be for real, not something theoretical. So it's very interesting, the dishwashers. What do you do with the dishwasher? You run a cycle. You can't run, you ask Rabbi Wexler, Rabbi Congregation Azariah, you cannot run meat and milk in the same dishwasher. Okay? So you have a meat cycle. I then read the manual on the dishwasher to see whether you have any hot water cycles that I have two different dishwashers. I have a dishwasher here and I have a dishwasher in Israel. My dishwasher here is completely different than the one in Israel. Here, I have a dishwasher that runs, that has a rinse cycle. It's a separate rinse cycle that I can run it on. And it has two, and that's for the purpose of rinsing your dishes off. You rinse your dishes off. It's terrific for kashrut because it in fact has two applications of hot water. So I rule that after you've done the dairy wash, you put it through the rinse cycle. It has two applications of hot water. It's heat that's crucial. After that, you then run through you can put your meat in that dishwasher. My dishwasher in Israel is much more complicated. There is no rinse. It's a German dishwasher, the Miele dishwasher. And the Miele dishwasher does not have a Maytag here, which is very good. The Miele dishwasher is a much better dishwasher, to tell you the truth, but it's impossible for kosher. Because you have to run through the whole cycle. You have to run through an entire cycle.
If you open the lid on the top, you have a different layout.
I'm telling you, I read the manual. It's a pain in the neck. And it's a waste of water, too. And in Israel, you don't want to waste water. So it's a big pain in the neck. Why am I telling you this? I want to get to another point. I go to my neighbor's house in Jerusalem, and he's a Sephardi, a very from Sephardi. And he says, you know, Rabbi Wexler, I want you to know something. He says, you know, in our dishwasher, we put milk and meat together in the same dishwasher.
Same cycle.
The same cycle.
Wow.
Same cycle. I said, what? I said, how could you do that? He says, the reason we do it is because the tzok of Rav Avadya Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef, that you read about, is a big meshugana. Who is the Haredi rabbi, the head of all the Sephardim. He rules that milk and meat can go together in the same dishwasher. No Ashkenazi rabbi would ever give you such a ruling. I don't think a conservative rabbi, if there's a conservative rabbi who would ever tell you that. But the Haredi Sephardi rabbi has ruled, and this is the law in Israel for the Sephardim, that milk and meat can be in the same dishwasher. Right? Now, as I'm telling you, you're going in a certain direction here. Harav Avadi Yosef also went in that direction. Right? And he's not a reform rabbi. You just follow the Israeli media on Rabbi Avadi Yosef to see what a reform rabbi this guy is.
What's his reason?
He says that the heat involved
makes everything
is not greater to create any absorption.
It's not enough heat. Right.
And therefore, there is no transfer between milk and meat. The heat is not enough. It's simply not hot enough. Okay? Now, of course, you could have a dishwasher that heats there are dishwashers that have special heating cycles. We're not talking about that. I mean, you have to not have that kind of stuff on. But there is a way to set up your dishwasher. I'm just pointing this out to show you how, once you know how the law works, believe me, Rav Avadi Yosef is the author of many, many books which are profound books of halacha. He's a great halachist. He knows his stuff. The practice can sometimes differ, and even in Jewish communal life, we see this.
If Yatzar Lenepo is the principle, I mean, certainly
the question is, what is Yatzar Lenepo?
Yeah, but I guess if you can set your dishwasher, but I thought there's an established concept of what that temperature would be.
It depends on who you ask. All right, it depends on who you ask. I mean, again, I don't agree with this. I think it's wrong, but I must eat the food in my friend's house because what Rav Avadia says is halacha. And I have no way to dispute what Rav Avadia says. But we cannot go by that. That's not Ashkenazi halacha.
So would an Ashkenazi Haredi eat in a Sephardi?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Probably the answer is most would, but not all.
You would point out that the meal is in the wrong place in the door.
We continue. Thank you for coming out on such a difficult night.
Everybody is extremely slippery outside. So, very, very careful.